Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Eric Stoner, editor of the online news hub about nonviolence called WagingNonviolence.org. This podcast is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So what I like to do is always begin with a little prayer. So I invite everyone who's listening, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and just to relax for a moment and recenter yourself. And together, let's enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you infinitely. And let's welcome the nonviolent Jesus here with us and ask for whatever graces and blessings we need to follow Jesus on the path of nonviolence. Beloved God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life and love and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to live and practice the way of nonviolence, and bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will and to proclaim and live your way of active, creative nonviolence in the tradition of Jesus, Gandhi, Dr. King, and Dorothy Day, that we might do our part to help end poverty and war, racism and greed, injustice and nuclear weapons and the whole systems of violence, that we might be your beatitude people of universal love, compassion, and peace. We ask this in the name of the nonviolent Jesus. Amen. Hey, it's my great pleasure to welcome and introduce everyone to my friend Eric Stoner, founding editor of WagingNonviolence.org, which is an independent nonprofit media platform website that covers social movements and activism based in Gandhian, Kingian nonviolence all over the world. Since 2009, it has published original reporting on nonviolent action from contributors in more than 90 countries. Eric has reported himself from Afghanistan and the Philippines, and his articles have appeared in, I think, Rolling Stone, Sojourners, The Nation, The Guardian, In These Times, and elsewhere. Eric is also an adjunct professor at New York University, where he teaches a course on global justice and peacemaking. I myself have known Eric for decades, and I remember somewhere along the line, Eric, you called in the early 2000s and said, hey, we're going to set up this brand new website as a clearinghouse for all things about nonviolence with the best writers and the best news. And I thought that was great. But now it's totally taken off and recently had up to 1.3 million people reading it and following it. All this done on a shoestring budget with just a few staff people, Eric and our friend Brian. It's really a miracle. And I was happy to have you on, Eric, so that everyone would know about WagingNonviolence.org and hear about what you're doing. So, Eric Stoner, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
It's my pleasure. So, if people typed in WagingNonviolence.org, Eric, they'd find all these articles about campaigns happening around the country and the world and movements where people are organizing around the power of Gandhian, Kingian nonviolence to bring about justice locally and disarmament and, you know, positive social change for creation. It's been my view, along with our friends and teachers, Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan, who I'll later have on the program, that the only way positive social change happens, and I mean from Jesus to St. Francis and St. Clair to the abolitionists, the suffragists, the labor movement of the 30s, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and then the explosion, if you will, of nonviolent movements from, you know, the women's movement, the environmental movement, LGBT, to the end of apartheid, the nonviolent collapse of communism and the Berlin Wall, and all the other movements. The only way change happens is bottom up. People power, grassroots movement of nonviolence. And it's not just the human way to change, it's the spiritual way. You've been editing and collecting stories every day for the almost 20 years now. And here we are in our country in this terrible moment with the Trump administration bringing on full-on authoritarianism, oligarchy, and fascism. So let's start right there and dive into it. Tell me about what you're hearing, Eric, as you look around the country and people are writing to you and you're in touch with so many people about nonviolent organizing and campaigns in response to the Trump administration and all the bad things happening.
Yeah, I think contrary to what I think a lot of people think or feel right now, there's actually been a lot more protest and resistance to Trump than you might see in the mainstream media. I think that's the important point, is that a lot of these stories aren't getting the attention that they deserve. And once you start to really see what's happening, it does inspire hope, and you do see possibilities for how we can stop a lot of the bad from happening. And yes, I mean, when you look just from the very beginning, there's been actually widespread protests against, you know, the attacks on government by Elon Musk and Doge, and the freezing of federal funds, trillions of dollars of federal funds, which, you know, Trump has had to backtrack on many of his attempts to kind of hurt people and to kind of take control. I think you've seen, you know, widespread protests in support of migrants and immigrants more generally around the country, in LA and every other major city. Farm workers have engaged in stay-at-home strikes. Students have walked out of schools to protest ICE raids. Cities and churches are standing up as sanctuaries and saying they're going to take in and protect people. So it's really inspiring when you actually see all the things that are happening. And then there have been some actions that just need a little reframing to kind of see their power. So, you know, a couple of weeks ago when Elon Musk sent out that email to every government worker requiring that they send a list of five things that they've done in the last week, something like 1.5 million people just refused. It was kind of an act of mass noncompliance, maybe one of the largest in U.S. history. And then, you know, you had this economic blackout, they were calling it, on February 28th. And I just saw that Forbes had a story that talked about a poll where they interviewed consumers, and they found that 16% of people they talked to said that they were participating in this boycott. So if those numbers are right, that could mean up to 40 million people participated in this boycott, which is really incredible. But has anybody seen that in the news? Has anybody really heard about that? It's kind of shocking. And then finally, there's been really, you know, I think inspiring protests around Tesla, which I've enjoyed seeing, where they've been protesting at Tesla dealerships and have really tried to and been successful in kind of tanking Tesla's stock price. And one estimate was that it's actually knocked off $100 billion off of Elon's net worth, which is just incredible. So yeah, there's just so much happening, right? And now there people are talking about tax resistance. They're talking about organizing a general strike. So there's just a lot that is happening under the radar of the mainstream media that I think should give us some hope and inspiration.
Well, that's very hopeful and encouraging to hear you say it like that. And you're right. I haven't heard any of these things except when I see them on wagingnonviolence.org. So the boycott in particular, you know, my friend and great teacher, Philip Berrigan, the great activist, and his brother Daniel. Phil, shortly before he died, in response to my book about Gandhi, you may remember in 1919, Gandhi, it's in the movie Gandhi, Gandhi calls for a total boycott of everything, that the whole country is to shut down for a day of prayer and fasting. and everybody laughed at him. And 300 million people stayed home. And that was the beginning of the end of British rule. And the British were appalled. And Phil wrote a long essay saying that's what needs to happen in the United States. And he died not living to see any of that happen. And Dan said, when the day he died, well, someday this will happen and it'll be in the record. I'd never heard anybody call for it. In all my years of activism, I'd never seen anything until February 28th. And they were very clear, this was just a few weeks ago, especially Walmart, Target, any big chain store, no gasoline, right? And I didn't do that. And so I was studying the press. I just want to hear a little bit more about what you think about this. And the next day, the New York Times had a real horrible personal attack on the founder of the boycott. Nothing about the boycott, but just attacked him on the front page. I was impressed. I mean, they showed their cards. And if you're saying that 16%, that is millions and millions of people, and that has to really make a dent. And then, just to follow up on that, it's, you know, when I had conversations with Cesar Chavez of the farm workers in the 80s and the 90s, he said the most important tool in nonviolence is the boycott, hands down. You know, it worked for Gandhi, and the boycott is how apartheid fell, period. Once the global boycott on apartheid happened on South Africa, apartheid was doomed because they couldn't run the country. And he said, that's what we did, and we needed to get 3% of the country to boycott grapes, and we got 17%. And it just changed the grape industry. Where do you think this is going to go? Yeah. What are you hearing? These organizers are calling for continued boycotts like every month this year, and I think it's going to ramp up. And that would be my hope. But how do we help spread the word and make sure it's rooted in nonviolence somehow? And it's got to become contagious, because don't you think that's how nonviolence works, Eric?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think this was the success of this boycott, I think, was it was extremely contagious. I think people are desperate for ways that they can act and show their opposition to what's going on. And so this really spread without much organization at all. It really kind of spread through social media, through things like TikTok. And, you know, it was like really impressive the amount of how it caught fire, given how little actual organization there was behind it. And I think the challenge now, right, is to, you know, what made Gandhi and Chavez successful was that there was a lot of serious organizing that went, you know, on the ground kind of organizing to build those boycotts. And so I think the challenge will be to what extent we can actually give real kind of infrastructure and real education around how are boycotts successful. And so I think that's going to be what we need to do, because there have been many calls for boycotts of particular companies or industries, or, you know, days of actions, weeks of actions over the next couple months. But it still is being spread largely online and doesn't have, from at least from what I know, like major organizations kind of behind it, or labor unions or things like this. So I think, you know, we're going to have to get more strategic and more planning and more training to kind of increase, you know, our effectiveness with the boycott. But I think it is one of the most powerful tools that we have, and we're kind of just learning how to flex that muscle right now. But I think it's encouraging to see how much this idea already kind of captured people's imaginations.
Yeah, it's very exciting and very hopeful. Can you say a word about the media not covering it? I mean, the media absolutely cannot cover the boycott of all their major sponsors, because it's the end of the mainstream media then, isn't it? I mean, so we're just going to have to, as you say, do a lot of grassroots organizing and word of mouth to build on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the major media are also major corporations in themselves, and they have their own corporate interests and their own sponsors. And yeah, so I think by their very nature, they're going to be doing what they can to kind of squash, you know, efforts like this. So I think this is where you really need to find alternative sources of information, you know, and I think social media is one way that, you know, these ideas are not kind of totally controlled by some big corporation. So I think, you know, also obviously waging nonviolence, you can find all this information. I really recommend Choose Democracy as well, which has been collecting a lot of this information and started a site called Boycott Central, where they're collecting information about all these different boycott efforts and historical case studies and trying to teach people about how to do this more effectively.
So that's choosedemocracy.org?
Yes.
And boycottcentral.org?
Boycott Central, I think, is a sub project under Choose Democracy. Okay. So if you go there, you'll be able to find more information there and sign up for that mailing list to kind of keep up on all the different boycott efforts and research and to go deeper on this.
That's great. So one of your writers, whom I don't know, Daniel Hunter, started writing about organizing against Trump early on, and he's attracted, it seems like, millions of readers. And he wrote a big piece on your site after Trump won re-election, and he's now written another one with tips on resisting tyranny and authoritarianism and oligarchy under the Trump administration as things are moving very fast. And I wonder if you could just sum up some of Daniel Hunter's main points for us and what you think about his arguments and any other suggestions you have about specifically about what people can do in terms of waging nonviolence against the Trump administration and the collapse of democracy.
Sure, yeah. So the story was published really on the day of the election, and it just exploded the following day and has kind of been the biggest thing that we've ever done in our 15 years of running the website. And people really ran with it in so many different ways. There were people organizing trainings around it and turning it into zines. And somebody wrote about developing a college course around the article. So it was really inspiring to see how...
This is from November, the recent election?
This is from November, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it still is getting a lot of traction on our site, even though, you know, it was written for that moment. But I think it's because a lot of the advice is really sound. And he kind of has 10 points that he develops to look at how we can stay grounded and be prepared and resist kind of effectively in this moment against Trump. And he starts off by actually developing more around kind of the psychological and emotional work that we need to do in moments like this. And I think that really struck people. But he starts off by talking about, you know, needing to trust yourself, trust your instincts, right? To find a small group of people that you can get together with regularly and process what's happening and try to build something with. He talks about the importance of grieving, that, you know, if we don't take time to grieve what is lost, we might act irrationally or lash out. And it's important to you know, appreciate what we've been through, right? If you're just kind of operating from shock about what's happening, you're gonna make mistakes. He then talks about, you know, the need to just release what you can't change, you know, to kind of, he says that, you know, it's kind of captured in the serenity prayer, right? God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. You know, there's a lot there about appreciating our own limitations, but also then thinking about what we can do, right? And kind of acknowledging that you can't respond to every single crisis, you know, right now we're being hit in so many different ways that it's kind of overwhelming. And I think it's important just to think about, you know, what you feel particularly moved by or you know, that you feel like you're suited for, and figuring out ways that you can get involved. And that'll be different for everybody. And we need everyone. So I think that's kind of an important point to remember. You know, there's also just this basic point about not obeying in advance, you know, this kind of anticipatory obedience that I think is really dangerous, where people see this threat of Trump and his attacks and kind of self-censor or toe the line. And you have seen a lot of that happening, you know, in the last few months by some powerful actors, you know, big corporations that have kind of given in immediately to Trump and politicians as well. But, you know, I think you also see a lot of people following this guidance, you know, that there's a lot of government workers who decided that they were not going to go along with these different orders and that Trump and Musk have made to try to, you know, destroy the federal government, which I think is really inspiring to see how they have been kind of pushing back and leading the charge in a lot of ways. And then, you know, he kind of finishes it by talking about how we need to be open to working across political lines, that there, you know, there might be some strange bedfellows in moments like this, and we need to be open to that, that we, again, kind of need everyone to be involved, and that there are going to be people that voted for Trump that didn't appreciate the threat and the danger that he posed, that are going to have their eyes open because of, you know, how this is going to impact them and people that they care about. And so I think we need to be careful not to write people off and kind of hold space for them to change. And we also need to hold on to really kind of a positive vision for the future. You know, it's less inspiring to just be talking about what you are against and what you want to stop. You know, we also have to have like a moving, inspiring vision for the world that we want. And so I think those are some of the ideas that he shared in that story. And I think, you know, they're good points that kind of hold at any at any point, you know. So I think that's also why it really resonated with so many people.
That's so helpful. Thank you. You know, one of the things about nonviolence that Martin Luther King says was nonviolence is power, and we have more power than we realize. And when I think of you, you know, you just said, well, you and your friends were going to start a website. Well, you know, I was an old guy then. Now I'm even older. I wrote, you know, write books and give talks, a website. And you stuck with it, and it's just grown, and it's begun such an impact for many people around the world as a source of information. And it just makes me think we all have more power than we realize if we dare just throw ourselves into the good cause and give it our all. So you've been at this for 15 years, editing this website and collecting stories about nonviolence around the world. And I think... I don't know that we've ever really talked about it per se over the years, but that must be an amazing experience, because even when things are bad, you're hearing a lot of good stories. And so I wanted to ask you, what are some of the most powerful, maybe most memorable stories about movements, grassroots movements and campaigns of active creative nonviolence that you've written about or posted about in your years at wagingnonviolence.org?
Yeah, I think, you know, working on this site for that long, it's really been for me a blessing and kind of a godsend. I think it has, in a lot of ways, kept me sane and kept me more hopeful than your average person, because I am seeing all the time good people all around the world trying to make things better, trying to push back against injustice and violence, and more often than you would imagine, winning, you know, and actually making a real impact. So I think that's just been one of the best parts of working on this for so long. I also feel like it's been nice to see when you really kind of focus on this topic, you can see things coming before other people. So I feel like we've kind of gotten ahead of a lot of different organizations or movements that, you know, have then gone on to make huge change and really impact the culture and the policies and of our country. And I feel like, you know, seeing that has been really powerful. So, you know, our first big kind of moment happened around Occupy Wall Street. We're based in New York, and so we were able to actually publish the first story on the internet about Occupy Wall Street before it was even existed. And we kind of, I think, played an important role in kind of becoming a hub for information around Occupy. And it was really, you know, an inspiring thing to go deep on and to be a part of personally. And then, you know, I think climate has been a major focus of the site. And we've been able to tell really kind of early stories about movements that went on to really change the country. So the divestment movement around fossil fuels that started at Swarthmore and kind of has become a huge international movement, you know, withdrawing trillions of dollars from fossil fuel investments. We published actually the first story about the Sunrise Movement. They came to us before they had ever done any protest, and we shared their story and what their vision was. And so, you know, that was super inspiring to see them go on to become kind of a leader of the movement in the U.S. and really, you know, put the Green New Deal on the political map. And
tell people what Sunrise is. Not everybody.
Sunrise is a group of young people who really care about the climate. And also it kind of grew out of the student divestment movement on campuses. But they kind of really hit the scene when they occupied Nancy Pelosi's office back in 2018. And, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined them and it became a huge story. And they had this vision of the Green New Deal, and they were the ones that really kind of made that an issue that everybody had to pay attention to. And they, I think, were, you know, the real inspiration for the Inflation Reduction Act that, you know, won, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars for the climate and was one of the biggest, you know, climate victories in history. So I think without Sunrise, we would not have had that success. And, you know, I feel very honored that we were able to kind of publish the first story about them. And then, you know, I'm always very moved by international stories, which I think are often, you know, neglected by the wider media. And I feel like there are so many inspiring stories from other countries of nonviolent movements that have taken on and overthrown dictatorships and authoritarian regimes and won other huge victories that are just not on the radar of most people. And I think we need to learn from what's happening outside of our country, and there's a lot to learn. So, you know, just one story that struck me that we published just last month was about the recent movement in South Korea. Did you follow that?
A little bit. Tell everybody.
So there was a president in December who announced martial law. And so there was a real threat of a kind of a self-coup, they call it, where somebody who's already in power tries to solidify their power and, you know, kind of crush their opposition. And, you know, people just rose up, you know, really spontaneously in that moment. And there were they went to the parliament and stopped the troops from entering the parliament. There were real showdowns where people were just blocking tanks and blocking troops. And then parliamentarians were scaling the fences of the parliament to get in to vote to stop the martial law. And it was just this incredibly inspiring movement. And then they stayed there after they succeeded in stopping the martial law within hours. And over the next few weeks, they just were on the streets every day. You know, at the peak, there were millions of people out on the streets. The president was arrested. And it's just the kind of thing, when you study these stories, you realize, like, this is the kind of urgency and energy we need to see more of here. And we have a lot to, we could learn a lot from their example. So, you know, we have all these incredible stories like this that, you know, it's important for folks that care about social change and trying to improve this country that we need to kind of learn from.
Wow, that's great. It's so exciting. Because we're friends, I had asked if it would be okay if you would share a bit of your own personal journey. So the question is, how did you get involved in nonviolence? And I know it involved your own health crisis, but what's so moving for me is you made a real conscious choice when you were younger to just say, okay, I'm going to do my bit for nonviolence, and here you are, changing the world. If you wouldn't mind, would you share with our listeners your own journey?
Thanks, John. Yeah. I grew up as a pretty traditional Catholic, and, you know, was never really exposed to nonviolence in my education or my church or my kind of upbringing. And so I was actually pretty conservative politically up until college. And I was then, for the first time, really exposed to the nonviolent Jesus when I took a class in Washington, D.C. with Coleman McCarthy, who is just an incredible teacher and journalist who really changed my life in a lot of ways. He just shared so many powerful stories of nonviolence and peacemakers that were, I had never heard of. And it really touched my heart. I felt like I had a conversion that summer while I was in DC, and I felt like I needed to change my life. It also was connected, like you mentioned, to my health. I have cystic fibrosis. And at the time, you know, the life expectancy with the disease was probably maybe in the 30s or in the 40s. So I kind of grew up feeling like I didn't have long, and I felt like I wanted to do something meaningful with my life, and I wanted to try to help people. I felt like I think having that illness also gave me an appreciation for just the vulnerability of life, and made me, I think that made nonviolence more appealing. I thought, you know, given the little time that we have on this earth, like, why would we spend that precious time trying to hurt others or trying to kill others? And we need to do whatever we can to kind of protect life in all its forms. And so I just felt like when I learned these stories of nonviolence, it just was incredibly inspiring for me. And I felt like I decided to make that my life's mission. And so, yeah, that was a transformative experience for me, and I think it did have a lot to do with why I chose nonviolence.
And you're doing well these days, and carrying.
Yeah, there was also a big breakthrough with my health in the last few years that has kind of changed the trajectory. So I'm very thankful to still be here and still being able to do this work and kind of get into good trouble.
That's great. So you must have learned a lot of new things over the decades since Coleman's class and reporting on nonviolence around the world. And I know we don't have much time left, but maybe you could share a thought or two about what are you learning new these days? What are you thinking these days? And even as you teach it at NYU about nonviolence and nonviolent action and even the spirituality of nonviolence.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've continually just learned over and over again how powerful of a tool nonviolence is for social change. I think it's really, like you said, the most powerful tool that we have. And, you know, that, like you mentioned, I think everything that we have that is good today was won through nonviolent struggle. And, you know, but that to get good at it, we need to study it and we need to practice it. And I think, you know, being grounded in faith is also very important and can, I think, give us staying power, right? Because there's a lot of ups and downs when you're in the struggle and doing this kind of work. And, you know, having faith and spirituality and a belief in God gives you a kind of a long-term perspective, right? That it's not about needing to see immediate progress, you know, that you are taking action because you believe that you are on the side of justice and doing what is right and trying to take care of people. I've just been reaffirmed over and over again in that by doing this work. And, you know, also just seeing the power really of love, you know, that that's what it comes down to, right? Is that we're meant to take care of each other. And, you know, that's kind of our highest purpose. And nonviolence is like a beautiful way to live that out. And really to not to write people off, you know, to not give up on people, that we need to kind of respect everyone's humanity and really work towards, you know, building King's beloved community.
Wow, that's so beautiful, Eric. Thank you so much. As we end, let me just ask, is there any other last thought you'd like to share with our listeners? That was a pretty good one, calling us to love.
Yeah, I think, you know, in this moment, we all should try to find, you know, community. I think community is really key to surviving moments like the one we're going through. I think it's important for everyone to kind of look for people that they can connect with right now, especially local efforts, you know, maybe in their church, or, you know, there are over 1,000 Indivisible chapters and there's many springing up in the last couple months. You know, there's groups like Third Act, if you care about climate, that are specifically for folks over the age of 60. And, you know, they're doing incredible actions around the country. So, you know, we need to find each other right now and, you know, also try to find news and information that kind of counters the despair that I think a lot of us are feeling. So we need to kind of realize that this is we're in this for the long haul, right? This isn't a sprint, it's a marathon, and we need to do what we can to take care of each other right now.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks, Eric. And all our friends listening, you know, please visit Eric's great website, www.wagingnonviolence.org, and make it one of your regular places to go to find out what's happening. So thanks, Eric Stoner, for speaking with me today. And thank you, friends, for listening to another episode of the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at www.beatitudecenter.org. And please consider offering a donation to support this free work and maybe even leaving some positive feedback or review on Apple or Spotify or the National Catholic Reporter or whatever platform you use. So thank you so much. May the God of peace bless everyone. Keep on following the nonviolent Jesus, and see everybody next time.